Why don't we start? Let me say again that all the classes, the previous 12 classes, are now online. I just want to make two corrections to things I said yesterday, last class. I mentioned Rabbi Henkin's book, B'nai Vanim, and he has a discussion there about how to relate to the Satmar Rebbe, and I said it was volume 3. It's actually, I checked, it's volume 2. And also, we got into a little discussion about the Belzer Rebbe's brother who gave this drasha, saying that there would be no Holocaust in Hungary and that they were not leaving for because of any problems. And then there was, of course, a Holocaust in Hungary. And I said that he also said that that he criticized the Zionist leaders and said that there would be no Holocaust in Hungary because there was no Zionism. I checked that there's others who have said that, but he didn't actually say that. He just criticized the Zionists and said that there would be no Holocaust, but he didn't actually attribute it that to the fact that there were no Zionists. Now, today we have to, we gave the context of the Satmar Rebbe's life, his biography, his background last class. Today we'll do a little more of that, but we're going to focus on his theology, his ideology, which has had a great deal of impact. As we mentioned last class, obviously the Naturei Karta look towards him, but so do the mainstream anti-Zionists who have nothing to do with meeting anti-Semites or, and as I said last class, and the Satmar condemned Naturei Karta for that. But first, we have to note that anti-Zionism was not invented by the Satmar Rav, Satmar Rebbe. When Zionism first began, what we call Chibat Zion, it struck a chord in East European Jewry. East European Jewry was persecuted. They never felt that they were part of East European countries. Many of them in Poland, for example, and Russia, didn't even speak the language of the country. On the other hand, Jews in Germany and France and England had achieved emancipation, and they were very worried about this new idea of Zionism. It was going to bring up questions about their political loyalties. Even the Orthodox in Western Europe were anti-Zionist, almost exclusively, not all of them, but most of them, for both the religious and political reasons. Hirsch wrote a famous letter to Ratzvi Hirsch Kalischer, the great Rav, the early religious Zionist, telling him that not only does he not think what he's doing is a mitzvah, he thinks it's a sin. That is, trying to build colonies and bring about a mass return to the land of Israel. Hirsch took very seriously the notion of the three oaths that we'll talk about in a few minutes that the Jews were supposedly forced to take by God, one of which is that the Jews will never rise up and try to retake the land. There's another oath that they would not rebel against the nations of the world. So when people say that Hirsch was an anti-Zionist, they are 100% correct. He opposed establishing a state before the Messiah. He opposed Mass Aliyah. He opposed the establishment of settlements before the Messiah. The only thing he supported was individuals who want to go live in the land of Israel. That was fine. That had always been done. For someone like Hirsch, the Jews' only fatherland, in Germany, that is, until the Messiah, was the country of Germany. That is, his fatherland was Germany until the Messiah comes. And this was the viewpoint in England and France as well. Now, question here. Well, that's the question. How would Hirsch relate to it now? We're going to speak about that in just a minute, a few minutes, with the rest of the anti-Zionists. The Hirschian community, Breuers in New York, continued pretty much their anti-Zionism. Yitzhak Breuer, the grandson of Hirsch, adopted an entirely different path. He went to Aliyah, and he argued that Hirsch always believed in Torah im Derech Eretz. And Yitzhak Breuer coined the term Derech Eretz Yisrael, that now the new Derech Eretz is the life in the land of Israel, and that Hirsch's ideology was built to respond to any civilization, which means that if you're living in the land of Israel, and that's the fait accompli, you deal with it, and you respond to it. And we'll see that is the response of the other anti-Zionists as well. There are two branches of the Hirsch descendants. The one in Israel became pretty much religious Zionists, Poalei Agudat Yisrael, and the ones in New York remained anti-Zionists. As I said, the Jews in Eastern Europe, though, were big supporters of the settlement in the land of Israel. But matters got more complicated when Zionism, political Zionism, began to include, first of all, when political Zionism came into existence and you had all these non-religious Jews, and they also wanted to establish states. And more importantly, when they included culture, Achad Ha'am's great idea that the land of Israel would be the place of Jewish culture, when they voted to include culture in the Zionist program, that caused a lot of the Orthodox to drop out. At the turn of the century, by the turn of the 20th century, you already have strong anti-Zionism among Orthodoxy. In fact, it's possible that most Orthodox were anti-Zionist. Rabbi Yehuda Cook always claimed that most Orthodox were in the middle. They were not anti-Zionist, but if you read Salmon's book on Orthodoxy and Zionism, he argues, I think convincingly, that most Orthodox were anti-Zionist, although with a large contingent of Zionists. The two strongest opponents of Zionism, and so strong, in fact, that they refused to go along to join the Aguda, which wanted to make some sorts of agreements, some sort of working relationships, were Chaim Soloveitchik and the Lubavitcher Rebbe. They were the two strongest opponents of Zionism. The Aguda was also, in theory, opposed to political Zionism. They were formed as an anti-Zionist organization. And there were some members of Aguda that really wanted to fight the establishment of a state. They wanted to appear before the British and say there should not be a state of Israel. Rav Hanan Wasserman, for example, is the famous example of one who opposed the state of Israel, and his writings today are reprinted by the Satmar. But the majority position of Aguda was not so extreme. Most of them were opposed to Zionism. In fact, most of them would have preferred there never be a state rather than a state ruled by the non-religious. But seeing that a state was going to come into existence, they agreed that if you're not going to be in the landing, in the takeoff, you won't be there in the landing. And they agreed that they have to go before the British and voice their support for the state that's going to come into being. If there is a state, that it should take into account religion. They did not actively oppose the Zionist movement once it was clear the state was going to be formed. On the contrary, when they realized by the 1940s, even the late 1930s, that a state was coming, they tried to organize their people to be in there, to have involvement with it, so that when it did come to fruition, they would be able to have influence and try to make sure that the anti-religious decrees were not passed, etc. The Aguda's position, though, even Rav Chaim Wasserman, it was always a practical issue for them, namely, how to best ensure religious interests. The criticism of the Zionist program was always that the Zionists are not religious. They're not going to have a religious state, Torah is not going to be important, Shabbos is not going to be respected. For the Gedolim of the Aguda, and this included all the Gedolim, there was no theological problem with the creation of a state. The problem was the people establishing it. If the people establishing it were all religious, the Aguda would have no problem with the state of Israel. For them, that is for the Aguda, the notion that you must remain in Golos until the Messiah comes was never accepted. The Aguda always regarded living in the land of Israel as a great mitzvah. The Gera Rebbe established settlements there. The Gera Rebbe visited, I think, 5 times. Many Aguda figures spoke about how important it was to live in the land of Israel. And when the non-religious started establishing settlements, it became very important for the religious. But the mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz, living in the land, was always regarded by them as important. And when the state was established, they created a political party, they got themselves elected to the Knesset, and they interacted with the other parties just like they did in Poland. Although they were opposed to the secular government, the Aguda figures, the Gedolim, saw God's hand watching over the Jewish people in creating the state, especially in the wars that the State of Israel won, despite the sins of the non-religious. So therefore, if you read the writings of the Aguda figures in the late 40s, early 50s, they always speak about the great miracles achieved by the Israeli army. And they criticize the non-religious for not recognizing that all these miracles and that the victories are not due to the great Israeli army, although there was a great Israeli army, they said, but precisely because of God's providence. Just like they would argue that if a doctor who's able to perform a great operation recognizes, although he's the tool, the real author is God, the Aguda figures were very clear about the great miracles. Nisim Gluyim, they spoke about open miracles, which God did through the non-religious and through the army. And they will speak, of course, about the miracles of Entebbe. Ramosha Feinstein famously wrote that this was an open miracle, not a hidden miracle. Most miracles today we speak of as hidden miracles. Even the Hanukkah story, you see writings of it that speak of it as a hidden miracle because it can all be explained rationalistically. Ramosha Feinstein writes that the Entebbe is not a hidden miracle. It's actually an open miracle. In fact, I will say that under Rebbe Yoshev's guidance, the current Gadol, the leader of the Aguda, they have even abandoned their old position. For 40 years, the Aguda wanted, or 50 years, wanted nothing to do with the official rabbinate. The Stipler, the great Stipler Gaon of the previous generation, ruled that it was forbidden for Haredim to have anything to do with the official chief rabbinate and the Beit Din, you couldn't be a Dayan, etc. Today, under Rebbe Yoshev's guidance, on the contrary, they see it as their goal to take over the chief rabbinate and take over all the positions of the Dayanim. And now Rebbe Yoshev himself used to be a member of the chief rabbinate. So there's been a complete change. And this is why the Aguda position, and we spoke about this with the Chazon Ish in the last session, is not regarded correctly as anti-Zionist, but non-Zionist. How can they do the about-face, Jonathan Hirsch asks? They are led by the Das Torah of their Gedolim, and if you want to look at it realistically, you'll say that Rav Yosef has a different opinion, and that's simply the answer. But you can even argue from a theological perspective that they could say that today the situation is different, so you need a different Das Torah for a different situation. But there's no question that Rav Yosef's position has always been different. He always believed in conquering the state of Israel, just like Chabad does, conquering the official rabbinate, rather than keeping away from it. Then I really don't think Aguda figures have a problem. They're not like Chabad. Chabad has a real problem speaking about differences. So when you look at the last Lubavitcher Rebbe and his differences regarding Zionism compared to the three Lubavitcher Rebbes ago, they have to argue, well, the situation has changed. They really can't acknowledge that the last Lubavitcher Rebbe had any differences. But Aguda figures are totally upfront about the fact that Rav Yoshev has a different perspective than Rav Shach. Yes, until Rav Goren became chief rabbi, Rav Yoshev was a member of the chief rabbinate. He was a Dayan. He was on the base stint. Rav Yoshev comes from that same milieu as Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, as the Tzitz Eliezer. They weren't card-carrying members of Mizrahi, but they weren't Agudists. In fact, they were much closer to Mizrahi. There was a very firm religious Zionist component in Jerusalem. From Mea Shearim, you have Rav C. Pesach Frank, Rav Aryeh Levine, Rav Yishai Zalman Meltzer. And this is where Rav Yoshev comes out. So although the Aguda decided, the Brisker Rav said it was forbidden to step foot into Heichal Shlomo, the chief rabbinate, Rav Yoshev was part of it, and many other big rabbanim who were, Rav Tukachinsky. So it's a different type of Aguda. They never were Agudistic. Lubavitch, incidentally, had a theological problem with the establishment of the state. But once the state was established, the debate was finished. The fact that there are millions of Jews living in the land of Israel, it's now a matter of pikuach nefesh, it's a matter of life and death, and therefore Chabad has forgotten about any old theological objections, and Israel's a reality, you must deal with it. But Satmar had a different approach. And it really didn't, again, originate with Satmar. The originality of Satmar is really post-48. Before 48, the Satmar Rav, as we said, wasn't that well known. He was actually overshadowed by the Rebbe of Munkach, Rav Chaim Moses Shapiro. Satmar is unique in that virtually all the other opponents of Zionism, the Hungarians, you have Vizhnitz, you have Belz, you have Bubov, of course you have Lubavitch and others, once the state was established, they made their peace with it. I mean, it's one thing to argue against creating a state when it's not established, but once it's established, what are you going to do? You work with it, just like you worked with Poland and Hungary. They thought it was enough to say that this state is no better than Hungary. That is, it's a secular state, and in Hungary, we went to the parliament and we involved ourselves, so Israel's no worse. The uniqueness of the Satmar is to say that Israel is actually a lot worse, as we will see. The Brisker Rav, incidentally, shared many of the same ideas as the Satmar Rav, but he disagreed with him on one thing. Satmar Rav believed in all these protests we'll talk about. The Brisker Rav was against any of this. He was a big anti-Zionist, not for theological reasons, but just for other reasons. He just thought that it was destroying Torah. But when the Satmar and others used to protest against the state of Israel, everything they did, you know, all the things they protested, the Brisker Rav rebuked them terribly. He says, the fact that you're protesting, he said this to the Aguda figures as well, shows that you give it some sort of importance, some sort of chashivas. When you were in Poland, You would never protest against a movie theater open on Shabbos. You would never protest against an archaeological dig. You would never protest against any of these things. The fact that you're protesting shows that you feel that you have some connection to the state. You want things to be changed in it, when instead you should react the same way you would in Poland. Yes, if they're coming down your street and doing something, you make a protest. But you wouldn't protest about the state per se and the ethos. And that's what the Aguda and the Satmar were doing, many of them. And the Brisker Rub said, and from the Brisker Rub's perspective, if just like in Poland, if they had a siren that went off on Memorial Day, you'd stand up to show your respect. You do the same thing in the state of Israel, because this is just a, it's no different than Poland. It has no significance. And you have to treat it as no different. But the Satmar Rav had a different perspective. He thought, as I said, it was a lot worse than Poland. Now, the Munkacher was the leading opponent of Zionism in the 20s and 30s, and he really is a great Talmud Chacham, a real gadol, with wide-ranging knowledge, something you wouldn't expect from extremists. Like the Satmar, he was the Rav of the city. So he was a posek, and he too is as extreme as you can imagine, blasting the Aguda at every step of the way because of their compromises. And we will see many themes in Satmar that were previously in Aguda, so we don't need to focus on the Munkacher, but let me just point out two interesting things, which show that history has a sense of humor, or a sense of irony, and the Munkacher really needs his own class. Now, when his son was going to get married, his daughter, in 1933, he wanted, for some reason, he didn't get along with the other Hungarian Rabbanim. It's all dispute, the next round. So he actually went to Poland to find himself a son-in-law, and he found a big Talmud Chacham, or Baruch Abinovich, and there was a huge wedding. I have a whole book about the wedding. This is the famous wedding that Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg attended, and at the wedding, he gave the first of his unfortunate interviews playing down the Nazi persecution. There's even a video of this wedding, and as you see Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg standing under the chuppah with the Munkacher. It was so interesting. The Munkacher, the big anti-Zionist, anti-secular studies, was best friends with the Sri D.H. But this son-in-law, who became in 1937 the next Munkacher Rav and Rebbe, who survived the Holocaust, yeah, there are movies on the web. After the Holocaust, he becomes a Zionist. He moves to Israel. He becomes the chief rabbi of Cholon. So, of course, the Munkachers, he wasn't great enough to bring them along. The Satmar Rav, as we'll see, could have brought them along. So they had to reject him. And he wasn't interested in being the Rebbe. His son, though, became the Munkacher Rebbe. His son grew up partly in America, in Israel, in Brazil. And there's a real problem. They have no relationship with this Rebbe's father. He wrote an introduction to one of the Munkachers for him, and they censor it out. His daughter, the Munkacher's daughter, is a modern Orthodox woman. When my family lived in Vacation Village until about 6 years ago, the other daughter, the sister of the Munkacher, has a house in Vacation Village. So it's quite interesting. The second interesting point is that the Satmar Rav never mentions the Munkacher. He mentions other Gedolim, but the Munkacher was the leading Hungarian opponent of Zionism and of Aguda until his death, and the Satmar never mentions him. And I know that there was some feud between them, and I've asked a number of people, and no one's been able to tell me exactly why they fought. The first tshuva in the Satmar Rav's tshuva is actually to the Munkacher, but I've heard from many that there was a feud, there was a dispute, but no one's been able to explain exactly what it was, so I can't answer that. Now, the Satmar Rav, who in 1937 became the leading Hungarian anti-Zionist and the opponent of Aguda, I have a sefer at home and other writings in which they really blast the Aguda because, as I said, by the 1930s, the Aguda begins to make compromises, to set up settlements, to begin to work with the Zionists to protect their interests. But that was regarded as a heresy by the Hungarians. Now, as I said last class, the Satmar Rav was a great gadol. He wrote books of tshuvot. He wrote books on the Torah. And the reason why the Satmar Rav gets respect, grudging respect by everyone, even by the greatest Lithuanian Torah scholars, is because he really was in their league. The Litvisha, the Lithuanians, only respect Torah scholarship. You had these Polish Hasidic Rebbes who, from the standpoint of the Litvisha, are simply amoratzim, to speak frankly. And these Polish Rabbanim Rebbes always had a Dayan who was a Talmud Chacham, who would paskin, but the Rebbe itself, he inherited the position. The Satmar Rav, as we know, was the Rav of the city, who paskin shaylas. He was a great Lamdin. He knew all of Shas and Poskim. He had to be reckoned with. You could ignore these other Rebbes. You could ignore these other Hungarian anti-Zionists. The Satmar Rav was really in the league of the Litvish Gedolim, so he had to be taken into account. Now, his greatest work, which is a real tour de force, and I'm in Scranton, so I forgot it at home, but I showed you the book last week. It's a very thick book, and it's one of the most interesting and significant works of the post-World War II era, is called by Yoel Moshe, a play on his, it's a pasuk, it's a play on his name, Yoel. It has gone through probably 20 printings, and it's the defining work of Satmar Chassidus. I asked Rabbi Katz, Yisachar Katz from Yeshivas Chol Bnei Torah, a former Satmar, and he told me that it's just like Tanya for the Chabad. That just like all Chabad read Tanya, all Satmar, by the time they're teenagers, will have read by Yoel Moshe. Now, parts of it are very difficult, so that's not to say they all understand it. But everyone's going to read by Yoel Moshe because it is the most important work of the Satmar Rav. It's his defining statement. And, of course, as I said, this is just like Chabad study in addition to Tanya, Shas, and Poskim, so too Satmar study Shas and Poskim. You have certain Hasidus groups that really, they just focus on Hasidus. That's not Satmar. But they do, their major work is by Yoel Moshe for their ideology. Now, the fact that if you read it, it's almost impossible to find anything that I think any of us can agree with doesn't take away from the fact that it is of great significance. Now, it's divided into three sections. The first is called Maimar Shalosh Shavuos, and it's the anti-Zionist philosophy, which I'll discuss imminently. The second is called Maamar Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. We're talking about 150 pages, and it speaks about the idea of living in the land of Israel. And he develops the notion that there's no obligation to live in the land of Israel. In fact, it's not a good idea to live in the land of Israel when the non-religious are ruling it. It creates all sorts of problems. The land of Israel is only for the religious. Non-religious should not be brought to the land of Israel. If we could keep them from the land of Israel, we would. And the third section is called Maimar Lashon HaKodesh, which is against the use of modern Hebrew. It's a phony language invented by the non-religious. Hebrew is Lashon HaKodesh. It's supposed to be about Torah study. There's nothing wrong with speaking Hebrew if all you're doing is in the yeshiva, but to have a Hebrew language in which politics is discussed, in which you have pornography, in which you have secularists speaking it, that's forbidden, and therefore it is forbidden to learn or to speak modern Hebrew. And to this day, by the way, they don't teach Hebrew as a language, let's say, to the girls. They teach the Lashon HaKodesh to the boys. They don't teach Hebrew for their girls. I mention that only because in Israel, the girls generally have a very good Hebrew curriculum. In America and Israel, they don't learn Hebrew. They learn a few words so they can read a little Chumash and do some davening. They don't learn Hebrew, the girls. They're kept very ignorant. In this section, the third section, he also speaks about the, if I'm not mistaken, it's there. He speaks about the Chavetz Chaim's idea that women need to be educated, very much against Beis Yaakov. Girls can receive absolutely no education. They don't learn Chumash inside. That's correct. They're kept very ignorant. The Chavetz Chaim's whole idea was that it was a disgrace that girls would have it's one thing when they didn't have any education, but when they had a secular education, to say that they could have a secular education, have no Torah education, first of all, it makes no sense, and second of all, it would lead them astray. The Satmar's ideology is very different. You give them almost no secular education and even less Torah education, and keep them the way they've been living for, the last 100 years. Now, after the 67 war, the Satmar Rav published another important work, a smaller work, but it was needed, because what happened in 67? Everyone, including the Aguda figures, are speaking about the great miracles, the conquering of the land. You had Aguda figures who were speaking about that this was the beginning of the Messianic era. He called this work Al HaGula V'Al HaTmura, that is, concerning the redemption and its replacement, that is, the false redemption. Not much was added in terms of theology, but in terms of practice, he added something very interesting. After the 67 war, he ruled, and as Hasidim accepted this, that it was forbidden to visit any of the places captured by the heretics. So, for example, it's usher to go to Hebron, it's usher to go to the Kotel, the Western Wall, because it was captured by the heretics. By going there, you give glory to the heretics, and God does not want you to get benefits. He doesn't want you to give any glory, and if there's no reason, therefore, to go to the Kotel. We'll have the Kotel in the days of the Messiah. So it's almost like a super leftist. You can never cross the green line, even to go into East Jerusalem, which isn't true. I mean, you're allowed to cross the green line, but you can't go to any of the sites. You can't go to Bethlehem. You can't go to Hebron. Now, the name of this essay is the book, Al Hagu'ula v'Al Hatzmura. Again, all these works are always in print. The anti-Zionist Eda Haredi. There's an anti-Zionist group in Jerusalem that have always been anti-Zionist. They dress, you know, in the old-fashioned. They never accepted this. They go to the Kotel, they do all these things. This was something unique to Satmar. Other Hasidic groups who are anti-Zionist don't accept it either. The Briskers never accepted this. It's unique to Satmar that by doing this we're giving praise, as it were, to the dark side that we'll speak about that helps the Zionists. Al Hagu'ula v'Al Hatzmura, correct. So now let's look at the major themes in Vayoel Moshe, the major anti-Zionist themes. Norman Lamb, I should note, in one of his best articles in 1971, before he was president of Yeshiva University, wrote a very nice article, the first scholarly essay analyzing the Satmar ideology. And I'll make a few adjustments to it, but we should call attention to it. It was recently republished in his two-volume collection of essays. Since then, we have important studies by Aviezer Ravitsky and Alan Nadler. Yes, he first appeared in Tradition in 1971, and it really is a very good article. Now, the first principle of the Satmar Rebbe, the Satmar Rav, in Vayoel Moshe, is, first of all, redemption can only come about through miraculous means. Our job is to sit in the Golos, be passive, quietism. We are in exile, and any attempt to alter this state is a rebellion against God. Nothing more than that. Nothing less than that. And a rebellion against God is heresy. That's the essence of idolatry. You're taking another God. You're rebelling against God's words. So for the Satmar Rebbe, we must wait in exile until we're called back. Now, here, as in all places, he buttresses his position by citations from the Talmud, early authorities, later authorities, Rishonim and Achronim. Now, many of the sources are of the sort that they can be read in many different ways. They really are ambiguous. But he has authentic rabbinic sources that agree with him. For example, a famous one is Rabbi Yonasan and Ipshitz is very explicit that we must wait in exile until the Messiah comes. The religious Zionist perspective was always that we can help bring the Messianic era by settling the land. We spoke about this about Rav Cook. And the Aguda never had any problem with going to the land. But it's not surprising that there are sources which adopt the Satmar position. After all, if you take an issue like redemption and look at the entire breadth of rabbinic literature for 2,000 years, you're going to find all sorts of ideas. If you start with the assumption that Zionism is bad, it won't be hard to find sources to justify that stand. Much like if you start with the assumption that Zionism is good, you'll find sources to justify that position as well. In fact, in the Rav's description of why he left the Aguda and went to Mizrahi, the Rav has a famous essay explaining why he joined the religious Zionist movement. He needed to explain this because his grandfather, as I mentioned, was the leading anti-Zionist, and his family tradition was always opposed to Zionism. He doesn't say that he discovered that the anti-Zionist position had been misreading the sources, and that you have to look at other rabbinic sources. And what, is he going to say that his grandfather couldn't read the sources? How can he say that his uncle couldn't read the sources? He couldn't say that. That would be the height of disrespect. Instead, Rav Soloveitchik says that events in the world, the Holocaust, the rise of the State of Israel, return to Zion, that showed that the Mizrahi approach was correct. And it was God himself, as it were, deciding that the religious Zionist approach is correct, because look at the world. Look how important the State of Israel is. Now, once he establishes this, that the State of Israel is important, then you can start citing sources. The Locus Classicus, the famous source for anti-Zionism, is found in the Talmud, Tractate Ketuvot, page 111a, which I mentioned a few minutes ago. It's an Agadic passage, and it states that God made the Jews, after the temple was destroyed, swear two oaths. One is that they will not return to the land of Israel in force, and as the other is that they will not in general rebel against the nations of the world. That is, they're in exile, you don't rebel. Now, for some reason, Lamb was confused, and he thinks you have the expression of the three shvuot, the gimel shvuot. Lamb was confused, and he thinks that the Talmud has three oaths which the Jews are supposed to swear, and he gives a third one that you're not supposed to hasten the advent of the Messiah. Yet if you look in the Talmud, that doesn't appear at all. In fact, the third oath is directed to the non-Jews, that they should not oppress the Jews too much. Later on in that page of Talmud, they give a few other oaths, and one of them is Shelo Yirachaku et Hakeitz, that the Jews should not push off the end. And there are some versions that have it as Yidachku, that they don't force the end. But it doesn't appear in the standard text of the Talmud. But in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, there's a different version. This is what Lamb must have had in mind, but he didn't bother checking it. In Shir HaShirim Rabbah, you actually have four oaths. Three to the Jews: don't try to take the land by force, don't rebel against the nations, and don't try to force the end of time. Like, if you remember some years ago, some guy wanted to blow up the mosque, Dome of the Rock, to try to force the end. And then the fourth oath, directed to the non-Jews, is don't oppress the Jews too much. Now, I just mentioned that this is an Agadic passage, which will be very important in the response to the Satmar Rav. The standard religious Zionist perspective is that this is an Agadic passage. It's not, you know, it's, what doesn't have any authority, this idea that Jews were given an oath, as it were, that is, that God's wish is that they not force the end, or that they not go up to the land in force, that is, in numbers, as groups. However, Ravitsky has shown that, contrary to what the religious Zionists like to say, there are many Rishonim who did actually take this as a halakhic position. So the Satmar Rav is not unique in this. Now, the oath to the non-Jews is very important, however, because even if you take this to be a binding passage, look at it. There are two oaths, or three oaths, to the Jews and one oath to the non-Jews. And the fact that the non-Jews violated their oath would mean that the first two is not binding. Remember, the non-Jews were given an oath. We're not talking about a real oath, but God put it upon them, as it were, that they cannot oppress the Jews too much. They can oppress the Jews, after all, in Golos. Remember the Chasam Sofer from the very first class? Jews are supposed to be oppressed, but they're not supposed to be oppressed too much. Can anyone really say, after the Holocaust, that the non-Jews didn't oppress the Jews too much? So you have a number of figures that have argued that even if you say this is a real thing, the oaths, the fact is that the non-Jews broke their part of the bargain. The Satmar Rav devotes a large percentage of his essay to showing that really the two are not dependent. The fact that the non-Jews broke their oath doesn't mean that the Jews can break their side. Now, what does this mean, though? Go up, the Satmar Rav is speaking all about how the Jews have violated the oaths, they've gone up in force. What about the UN resolution? How can anyone say that the Jews are rebelling against the non-Jews when there was a resolution giving the Jews the land? But of course, I assume all of you know how this resolution came about, that it was due to Jewish actions. It came after the Jews arrived in great numbers, many coming illegally. It came after a rebellion was launched against the British, both a political rebellion, which was waged on all continents, trying to put pressure on the British to give up the mandate, and even a military rebellion by Menachem Begin and Irgun and Lehi, eventually forcing the British out, driving them out. Had there not been this rebellion, just like in India there was a rebellion, they would have left, but it would have been in the 60s when they abandoned their other colonial territories. The fact that they left when they left was because it was untenable for them. So the Zionists forced the issue, and without it there never would have been a UN resolution. That is a rebellion against God. Now, Lamb points out correctly that the Rebbe makes a number of stretches. For example, he has to consider why these oaths are never mentioned by the Rambam. After all, these are binding halacha, as the Satmar Rav continuously stresses. How come, if you look in the Mishnah Torah, and then the Shulchan Aruch, but certainly in the Mishnah Torah, which has everything, there's no mention? Look in Sefer HaMitzvos. There's no mention in Sefer HaMitzvos. So what does he say? He replies that because these are fundamentals of Judaism, these oaths, Judaism literally stands upon them, as such, they're not individual mitzvot. You don't need that. Just like you don't need a mitzvah to believe in the existence of God. If you look in the correct versions of the Sefer HaMitzvot, it's not to believe in the existence of God. It's to believe, to know that God exists. That is to do proofs and those sorts of things. But certain things, the Satmar Rav says, are basic to Judaism, and therefore you don't need to have a specific mitzvah. It is a huge stretch. But if you think it sounds ridiculous or think it's strange, consider this. Religious Zionists, and many of leading religious Zionist figures, including Rav Goren and others, have asked, since they argue that living in the land of Israel is so important, it's a mitzvah, we all have to do it, how come if you look in the Rambam, in both the Sefer HaMitzvos and in the Mishnah, he never says you're obligated to live in the land of Israel? And they too reply that because the Torah cannot properly be performed at all, except in the land of Israel, it's so basic, and the Rambam says in the Sefer HaMitzvah, he's not going to count these overarching basic ideas, therefore this too is basic. Now, the only problem with this is that none of the Rishonim, and certainly not the Ramban has his additions to the Sefer HaMitzvah, and addition number 4, he criticizes the Rambam for not counting living in the land of Israel as a commandment, and the Ramban says, no, the Rambam is wrong, and this is a commandment, and everyone is obligated to live in the land of Israel. So the Rambam does not count living in the land of Israel as a mitzvah. The Ramban does. This doesn't mean, by the way, according to the Rambam, it's not a positive thing to live in the land of Israel. There's certain mitzvah you can only do there. There's a holiness to it. But it's not an obligation. There's no mitzvah per se to live there. The Rambam says, once you live there, you can't leave. That he says. But forcing us to go there, there's no obligation. That's become the accepted view. According to the Ramban, all of us here are sinners. We're not living in the land of Israel. The only exemption you would get, according to the Ramban, is if you can't make a living there or you're studying Torah. But the idea that so you could say, well, I can't make 100,000, I can only make 40,000, that won't fly for the Ramban. For the Ramban, you must live in the land of Israel. It's a mitzvah. But the Rambam says you don't have to. And all the Rishonim and Acharonim pretty much point out that we hold by the position that you don't have to live in the land of Israel. It's really the Achilles heel of the religious Zionists. I remember when I was in Yeshiva, they're telling us we all have to live. The Ramban, we all have to move to the land of Israel. And then, of course, there's the famous Shiva Ram Moshe, who points out the obvious, that Klal Yisrael was never noheg. No one ever said that everyone has to go. It could be a great thing. It's a wonderful thing, but it doesn't mean it's an obligation, that you're a sinner. There could be great things you do, because it's just wonderful. But the idea that you're a sinner, which the Ramban felt, that was never accepted. Yes, the Rambam says you should live in Israel in a city of idolaters than in a from city in the diaspora. What to do? Is it Sama Rav? I mean, his position is that it's different if there's a city of idolaters, but when they're running the whole country, that everything has changed. In general, by the way, the Sama Rav feels that talking like you just quoted only referred to people already living in the land of Israel, but there's no obligation to go to the land of Israel. You don't even really get any benefit if the Beit HaMikdash is not built. But the standard position is, like Ramosha Feinstein really didn't know what to do with the fact that it's clear that living in the land of Israel is a great thing, but there's no obligation. So he spoke about this notion called a mitzvah kiyumis, that when you're living there, you receive great benefit, but there's no obligation. No one's been able to really explain what this means, a mitzvah kiyumis. It's not like wearing tzitzis, where some people have offered, Rabbi Kelman says, but it's not like wearing tzitzis. There's no obligation to wear tzitzis. If you have a four-corner garment, then you're mechuyav. There's no obligation, though, to go to the land of Israel. And Ramosha says, if you do, it's sort of like yumis. There's no parallel to tzitzis or sukkah or anything like that. Because if you eat in the food, you must eat in the sukkah. It could be perhaps, some people say, like matzah after the first night. It's a kiyumis, but it's not. Rav Avram Shapiro has a contrast against Rav Moshe on this very point. But in any event, we don't hold like that, at least I shouldn't say we, most people don't hold that you have to live there. Now the Rebbe, correct. The Rebbe actually tries, he makes a real stretch. He tries to make the Ramban even agree with the Rambam. All the others were content to say that the Ramban differs from the Rambam, but we all accept the Rambam. And what's the proof? Look at the proof is 2,000 years. Jews never went, they never thought they were obligated. They thought it was just a tzidkus, a nice thing, a great thing, a holy thing, but no one ever said it's an obligation. Therefore, that's the proof we don't hold like the Ramban. But the Satmar Rav tries to show that even the Ramban agrees with the Rambam, because the Ramban was only talking about when, let's say, the Turks ruled it, or the Muslims, or the Christians, but when the idolatrous Jews control the land, then there's certainly no obligation. Now, the Munkacher had actually argued earlier that until the Messianic era, there were certain ways it was actually better to live in Golos, better to live in Chutz La'aretz. For example, we have 2 days of Yom Tov. We all might think this is a punishment, this is an onesh, that we have to observe 2 days, two seders. The Munkacher thought this was actually a milah, a schar, that we had, and when he visited the land of Israel, on his famous visit, he made sure to leave for Shavuos, to be in Golus. He obviously held, he doesn't explain it there in the book, there's a whole book about his trip. They don't explain that he held at the Chacham Tzvi, but he obviously held that in the land of Israel you'd only do 1 day, so he made sure to go back to Chutz La'aretz to observe 2 days. Kabbalistically, he developed it, that it's more important. So until, for the Satmar Rav, though, there is no return until Mashiach comes, and no redemption until the Jews do tshuva. The name of his book is called Masa'ot Yerushalayim. I believe that's the name, Masa'ot Yerushalayim. It describes his visit, and the highlight of his visit to Israel, and he visits all the various sites, is when he goes to see the man known as the Saba Kadisha, Rav Shlomo Eliezer Alfandari, who was at that time like about 110 years old. He was a very old, pious sage from the Sfaradim, miracle worker, and the Rebbe visited him at Munkacher a few times. He was actually there when the Rav Alfandari's soul departed. So the Munkacher saw Rav Alfandari almost like a messianic figure. But it's called, if I'm not mistaken, Masa'ot Yerushalayim. The religious Zionists argued, and this was Rabbi Yehuda's big thing, that the Machlokes in the Gemara, will Messiah come with only with redemption or without it? The Rambam actually says with redemption. You need to with tshuva or without tshuva. The Rambam holds that you actually need to do tshuva. Others say not. The religious Zionists basically held that Jews don't need to do tshuva. The fact that we're returning to the land, the non-religious, they don't know what they're doing. They're helping the religious. We spoke about that. The Satmar Rav said, you need tshuva. No messianic era before tshuva. Remain in the Golos. He even said, speaking almost like a Reform rabbi, that the Golos has significance. We bring perfection, tikkun, to the whole world by being in our exile. And because we're in the exile, when redemption comes, it will be a greater exile, a redemption. And he quotes the Shlah as saying, amazing, I didn't believe it. I actually had to look it up. That the Shlah says that exile is good for God and good for the Jews, for the reasons that we're able to acquire tikkun. We're not ready to go to the land of Israel yet. We're not holy enough yet. For the Satmar, living in the land of Israel was like the Kohen going into the Kodesh Kadashim. Now, Alan Nadler has shown in his essay that there is even anti-Semitism in the Satmar's writings, by which I mean that if a non-Jew said what the Satmar said, we call it anti-Semitism. Now, some of you might have seen the interview they did last week with me in the Jewish press. And I was asked about Rabbi Weinberg, his comment that Jews bear some of the guilt for anti-Semitism. Now, I don't know if Abe Foxman will be going after Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg now, but certainly if a non-Jew said what Rabbi Weinberg said, that some of the anti-Semitism is due because of the way Jews act, definitely Abe Foxman would be hounding him, and it would be a whole cause to laugh. So what do I mean when I say that the Satmar Rebbe has anti-Semitism? Well, he said that the reason that the State of Israel has received so much support among Jews and among the West in general is that the Zionists know how to manipulate public opinion. He's going to develop now the whole notion of Zog, Z-O-G. If you don't know what it is, plug it into the internet. Zionist occupied government. That is, the Zionists control America, they control England, they control Australia, etc. He says that, quote, by exploiting the tremendous influence they have over virtually all of the world's newspapers and journals, exactly, that's what I said, the Zionists know how to manipulate public opinion. He also adds that they control the banks. This is a protocols of the Elders of Zion argument. Now remember how Rav Kook viewed the non-religious as the tools for redemption? They control our emotion. Remember how Rav Kook viewed the non-religious as the tools for redemption? For the Satmar, this is no less than heresy. Now if you ask, how can the Satmar declare that how God will act? The religious Zionists always said that God acts in mysterious ways. If God wants to bring the redemption through the non-religious, building up the land, who's to say otherwise? The Satmar's reply is that we have our holy sources and they tell us how God acts. Now, obviously, the holy sources can be read in more than one way. I have a very large book, which I left at home also, but as big as the Vayola Moshe by Rav Menachem Kasher, the great encyclopedic Rav Menachem Kasher, called Hatzkufa HaGdola, the Great Era, which is really a polemic against the Satmar Rav's position. He never mentions by name. He simply says some rabbi, and then he quotes long selections from Vayal Moshe to refute it. Now, I will say, though, that both these books, in terms of their arguments, Vayal Moshe and Atzkufa Gedola, don't really get you anywhere, because they're preaching to the converted. What they do, and this is positive, is that they give strength to people, strengthen the beliefs people already have. But you really can't disprove anything, because each side has plenty of positions. Each side can quote 20 sources. That's what makes the Rava's approach so interesting. He doesn't argue based on sources. You can quote, this Ramban, and then quote a Rambam. You quote Rosh and Leibschitz, I quote Yaakov End. I mean, tit for tat, you can quote sources. The Rav makes it an existential issue. He says, look at the state of Israel. Look how important it is for Judaism, especially after the Holocaust. Look at the yeshivas. Look at Torah growing in the land of Israel. This is what the Rav means when he says that in this great machlokas between Aguda, Satmar, and the Zvoda Zionists, God himself decided. He paskened. And we can all see now the positive value in the state of Israel, especially after the Holocaust, when people were, there was nothing left for it to them to be Jewish. If you go to countries like Argentina and Brazil, I mean, their whole existence revolved around the state of Israel. In other words, we're led to our Zionist approach because of our general evaluation of the importance of the state. And then we find Torah sources to support this. But if you have a different outlook on this, you're going to find different sources. There's really no truth with a capital T in the sense that we can prove it. We have our truth about the significance of the state. The Satmar have their truth. And the sources are secondary. And that's why for the Rav, he always stressed the existential aspect. It's really very hard. You'll see the length the Satmar goes to deny what we all can see, how valuable the state of Israel is for a variety of reasons, not least of which is the assimilation. All these Jews in Israel have no connection to Judaism. If they're living in another land, they would all be assimilating. So it's an existential argument for the Rav, not a source argument. Hashem also paskened in Achmai Zavin, and we rejected that. It's a very good question. The Rav doesn't consider that. I think maybe the difference is there that there were sources. So the argument there was over sources, and God paskens one way, and we then are supposed to reject our sources. In this case, the Rav is taking it out of the whole source thing. He's saying you have to look at it existentially. It's almost like if there was an argument over did Maimon Har Sinai ever happen, then all of a sudden Hashem appears and creates a mountain and all that. The Rav turns it into an existential thing, so it's no longer an argument about sources. It's a good question, though, but the Rav says it's existential, and God has shown us the truth. And we have to, now that we know the truth, we can examine the sources. But obviously, you can't convince someone otherwise. It's not a halakhic issue. And the Rav, it has to be an existential issue, because the Rav can't say it's any sources, or it's halakhic, or anything like that, because then he's saying his uncle, he reads sources better than his uncle. He reads sources better than his grandfather. And he wouldn't say that. His attitude is, once we accept existentially, this is what Hashem wants, now we read the sources, and this is what the sources speak to us. But he's not going to say that his grandfather is wrong, or his uncle is wrong, because his uncle doesn't recognize what happened. Not because his uncle misinterprets the sources, that the sources really teach us that we have to create a state, and his uncle didn't understand. No, his uncle, he explains, couldn't fit the state of Israel into any halakhic framework, and therefore his uncle rejected it. But the Rav claims, you know, that the Rav has a whole different perspective. That's how I read it. It is existentially fragile, but not from the Rav's perspective. The Rav never put himself, as we spoke last semester, into this messianic framework. The Rav never saw the state of Israel in messianic terms. For him, it was valuable for what it does, and therefore, if God forbid, it is not there anymore, Judaism goes on. Now, Judaism doesn't depend on it. You have religious Zionist figures who could speak about there'll never be a third destruction, etc., etc. Just like the people in the days of Ezekiel, in the days of Jeremiah, had this prophet going around talking about how the temple can never be destroyed, and Jeremiah refers to him as a false prophet, and he's actually, God condemned him to death. The Rav was a believer in realpolitik, and precisely because God forbid the state could be destroyed, you can't lean back and say, well, God will watch over us, and you need to work. It is fragile, no question. It's fragile, and we know how fragile it is. But for the Rav's Judaism, as I said, maybe we'll have a session on how the Rav viewed Zionism. Yeah, yeah, that is true. We have Rabbi Kelman has a very good memory. There was an article that wanted to, in tradition, that really adopted this messianic approach. This was the Gush Emunim approach. And
if I may interrupt, that was the article many years ago. What if Pastor Sholem Israel was destroyed, what would be the reaction in Orthodoxy, conservative reform in the 70s? And it was everything written by an English professor, I forget where, and the editors got slaughtered for printing such an article. How dare they print it? Because in the 70s, you couldn't say the things. Unfortunately, things have changed, and asking the question doesn't get the same, you know, anger. But anyway, that's an aside.
Okay, I thought you were thinking of another article that was published that maybe in response to that, speaking about how the State of Israel could never be, you know, it was the third return, et cetera, et cetera. I will tell you, incidentally, that the author of this article has become a very big heretic now, and he writes all sorts of terrible stuff. He's one of those, if you plug in his name, you'll see him on all these atheist boards and everything. I don't know what disillusioned him. In any event, continuing, this, unlike the rest of Orthodoxy, the Satmar holds that it's heresy to think that anything good for the Jewish people can come out of the non-religious. Now, he's only stressing the national level. The problem with the non-religious who take who claim that they were responsible for all these good things, the Satmar never said that you couldn't go to a non-religious doctor who's going to do a great operation, because then he'll say, well, I'm such a great doctor, and he won't thank God. But he's saying on a national level, with a heretical movement taking over the Jewish people, nothing good can come out of them. Now, what to say then about Israel's wars? Things like Entebbe, I mean, you're going to say that these are not great actions carried out by God through the Israeli army, etc. The Satmar replies, and there's a long section in Kashra's book on this, refuting it, but the Satmar believes that all these miracles and incredible things that the State of Israel has achieved come from the dark side, the Sitra Achra. The dark side is a Kabbalistic idea that there are forces of darkness, of evil, who operate in this world, and they are given free rein. They are tests of our faith. And all these things that you look at and see as signs of God's providence, or Moshe Feinstein saw as an open miracle, for the Satmar Rav, this is, you know, the devil can also do magic. This is a sign of the power of the Sitra Achra. And this is why the State of Israel is so dangerous, because the evil side, which is bringing everyone into this false ideology of Zionism and rejecting Torah, it is able to influence even religious Jews. Now, the Satmar Rav compares it to the situation in Egypt, where we know that if the Egyptian magicians did things, we don't change our belief. And the Zohar speaks about the Sitra Achra leading people to sin. The same thing. We see evil in our day. And the proof is it that non-religious Jews are doing these things. That must only be the Sitra Achra. I don't understand the question. Kind of like post-Hanukkah, is there anything about the Sari history in Satmar?
Post-Hanukkah, the Hashmonaim really descended to the depths, and it wasn't such a good thing after all.
Yeah, but what's the relationship to Satmar in that?
Do they have any awareness of this history, or of how, you know, great events can turn sour?
Oh, no question about it. Everyone, I mean, the famous Chassam Sofer, who says, and Chassam Sofer is the most important figure for the Hungarians, he says the reason why Hanukkah is never mentioned in the Mishnah is because Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and his Rashi, he didn't like the Hashmonaim. And the famous Ramban, I believe it's the Ramban, says because they usurped the kingship, and everyone knows about the terrible things that happened. The difference is that the Satmar Rav thinks that the whole state, there never was anything good. Hanukkah was good, then the bad came. This whole thing is from the evil side. No, and they never cite that, because there's nothing positive in this, and that's what makes it so terrible, that it's leading people into this heresy. By the way, he states this, after explaining how this is the evil side leading people into this heresy, heresy being Zionism, heresy meaning that we can establish a state, that we can work together with the non-religious, that we don't wait for God. After explaining how all this is the evil side for pages, he then says, well, this is only for those people of simple belief who want to say it's a miracle. Is Hanukkah a chag for Satmar? Sure, it's a chag for Satmar. It's a chag for everyone. But the Chashmonaim were tzaddikim. It's the people afterwards who weren't. That's the problem. The people who established the state were the evil ones. So there's no parallel. Now, the Satmar says all this business about the evil side, the Sitra Achra, this is only for those who insist on seeing it as a miracle. And if you insist on seeing it as a miracle, the Rebbe says we have a long tradition that the evil side can perform all sorts of miracles. But he says, the Satmar Rav says, that really there's no miracle at all here. There's nothing out of the ordinary in the victories. He sees all the victories simply as proof that Israel had technological superiority with nothing miraculous about them. Now, to be sure, it's ironic, because to be sure, today we know, especially with regard to the Six-Day War, you can read Michael Oren's book and others, that the Arabs were at a disadvantage in every way. And the victory was a foregone conclusion, although at the time, and some of you can remember this, if they were, no one thought so. But at the time, you thought it was a great miracle, but in retrospect, it was a foregone conclusion. And even with the 1948 war, although the Arabs had many more people, the Jews were better organized, so the victory can be explained in a rational way, as can all such victories, including the Chashmonaim victory. And you could say the same thing about Entebbe. If you have a theology forcing you to say it, you could say it. Of course you could say it. And because of this theology, all these events are either events from the dark side or natural events. By definition, nothing that gives glory to the Zionists has any benefit, can have any benefit. The very state is heretical because it doesn't enforce religion and it subsidizes non-religious schools and allows idolatry, by which he means Christianity, to exist in the land. For the Satmar, it is not only the establishment of the state that was a rebellion, even if every Knesset member was religious, but it continues to be run in opposition. For those who don't know, the non-religious are always saying that they achieved it on their own. But even if they all were religious, he says, even if every member of the Knesset was a Gadol B'Yisrael and said that it is all due to God, it would be just as heretical. The Satmar Rav says that the very notion of democracy is only for non-Jews. Democracy, he says, is a great system for the non-Jews. We live in the exile. It's a great system. But for Jews, the state must be run by Gadolim, just like in Iran. He claims that democracy is a complete heresy. For the Satmar Rebbe, everything is very starkly drawn. You know, my understanding, and most, I guess, is that there's a lot of gray in this world. But for the Satmar Rebbe, everything is either black or white, good or bad. For him, it's either a heresy or it's a great mitzvah. So he has loads of things are heresy in his mind. The only true believers left are the Satmar, as everyone else has been infected by the disease, which is the heresy of Zionism. And it's easy to see how this ideology can lead to more extremism, including the Neturei Karta visiting Iran. The Satmar believe that the state must be dismantled. And when the Mashiach comes, this is how it must be dismantled. You can't have Mashiach, redemption, with the state. The problem is how to dismantle it. They acknowledge that today you can't really dismantle it. They're not like the Neturei Karta, because Jewish lives will be put in danger. So instead, they hope for the Messiah to dismantle the state and recreate it. But since the state is a center of heresy, it's forbidden to take any money from it. The state is worse than Poland. You can't take any money from it. And I think you have to admire the Satmar for putting their money where their mouth is. Unlike the Aguda types, who from day one have seen the state as a source of money for their yeshivas, but give nothing back in the way of serving in the army or celebrating the state's achievements, or even stopping for the siren on Memorial Day, the Satmar refuse to benefit in any way from the state. It would be very easy for them to take money from the state. The state would give them all this money. They refuse to. They really stand up for their principles in a way that the Aguda never has. But the Satmar Rav was not just an opponent of Zionism, of Israel. I agree with you that they don't oppose Zionism per se, so it's not hypocritical, but it is hypocritical in the sense that they're willing to take all this money, but they don't give anything back. Part of citizenship means, I would think, to give something back. And they don't give anything back to the state. Satmar doesn't want to give anything back, so therefore they don't take anything, and they see the money itself as tainted. Okay, how do you say parasitical? Okay, I accept your definition. The Satmar Rav, though, wasn't just an opponent of Zionism, like Rabbi Chanan or others. He raised the heresy of Zionism to one worse than idolatry. The Holocaust was due to the Zionists. How so? They declared war on Germany and instigated anti-Semitism around the world so that Jews would be persecuted and expelled. And this would lead Jews to support Zionism and immigrate to Israel. He even claims that the Zionists tried to pressure countries around the world not to allow Jews in after they were expelled so that the Jews would be forced to turn to Zionism. And you have a number of books published by the followers of the Rebbe that have chapters, sections, the Rebbe's views on this, the Rebbe's views on that, and you can get all these views laid out for you. Now, I see it's already 10. I only have about 10 minutes left. I think we'll have to continue 10 more minutes the next class, because I think I have to balance it a little, that with all this rhetoric, what to make of the fact then that the Rebbe's followers do great tzedakah even today for non-Satmar, there seems to be an imbalance between the rhetoric that everything is heresy, therefore everyone's a heretic, and yet the real world in which many of them are kind, gentle people doing mitzvos. So that's, I think I have a good read on where you, about this. We'll have to pick that up next class. Again, just 10 minutes, even less maybe, because we're going to start with Ramosha Feinstein next class, but we do have a few comments or questions. Parasite in the springtime. Well, when you say straight out of a white supremacist handbook, that's what I meant when I said it's anti-Semitism. But we get into the other question. If an insider, if an in-group person says it, is it really... In-groupers can say things that outsiders can't. In every group, when Louis Farrakhan in the Million Man March is telling blacks that you have to give off welfare and get jobs, he can say that. Of course, if a white would say that, it would be racist. If Rabbi Weinberg says that Jews cause anti-Semitism by they don't treat non-Jews properly, he could say that. But if a non-Jew were to say that, like I said, it would be anti-Semitism. And I'm not necessarily saying that it should be different. You know, we can think that maybe someone in our family, we can be angry at our parents and think they did something wrong. But if someone else says, you know, your father really did a really bad thing, he might get offended because it's none of his business. You know, we assume that the insiders have the group's best interests at heart. But it is true that the rhetoric of the Satmar Rav can be used by Iran, by the white supremacists. It's the same rhetoric, and yet the Satmar Rav was a tzaddik. There's a famous story that some politician came to get votes because he could really deliver, and he came to the Satmar Rav, and he starts spouting all this anti-Israel stuff, and how he hates Zionism, and when he left, the Satmar Rav said, he's an anti-Semite. So they asked the Satmar Rav, oh, wait a second, he's saying the exact same thing you said. And obviously this politician had been prepped on what to say, and the Satmar Rav said, when I say it because I love the Jews, and I want to get them on the right track. He's saying it because he hates the Jews. In other words, the Satmar Rav said everything out of a great love for the Jewish people, and he thought that they were being destroyed. The fact that he said the same exact thing as some of these anti-Semites, I mean, I don't know what to make of it, but it's very different. Now we have Binko Cholim. I'll speak about that in Brooklyn. We'll speak about the next class. Next question is about Hirsch. Yes, Hirsch was more anti-Zionist than Yehuda. And in fact, his followers remain more anti-Zionist. You had many figures, by the way, in the Aguda who were not even really anti-Zionist. They were anti-political Zionists, but they believed, Ravishasal Meltzer, for example, they believed in a sort of religious Zionism, and they became Poli Aguda Yisrael types who believed in settling the land. Hirsch was a real anti-Zionist, an ideological anti-Zionist, whereas the Aguda were only tactical anti-Zionists. No, the Holy Zog thing is not traceable to the Satmar Rebbe, not at all. But it is ironic that they both came up with it on their own. So it leads you to wonder, is there any truth to Zionism? Ben Hecht, by the way, if you read perfectly, he certainly was a Zionist, a revisionist Zionist, And he accuses the labor Zionists, Ben Gurion Zionists, of also abandoning Jews in the Holocaust, that sort of thing. So if you look at Benny Morris's writings and Tom Segev, not everything that the anti-Semites and the Satmar Rebbe are saying are untrue. We do know that we have incredible quotes, by the way, of certain leading Zionist figures, how they wanted to create anti-Semitism, that sort of thing, so that Jews would be led to Zionism. I'm not going to say that the Satmar Rebbe is right, but there are troubling quotes. He's not 100% wrong. These early Zionists were trying to get people to go to the land of Israel. So if they wanted to create... Zionists have done some terrible things. I know you all know, so many of you I'm sure know, the Lavon Affair, bombing American and other Western institutions in order to create a backlash against the Muslims so that Jews would be portrayed better. I mean, what can I tell you? It's not, he's not all wrong. Neturei Karta is not Satmar. However, Neturei Karta sees the Satmar Rebbe as their leading light. If you look at their defenses, they always quote him. And many of them are not even Hasidim. And they are in the community, as I said last class. And they go to Satmar Dayanim. It's an incestuous relationship. And you have different types in the Neturei Karta. You have the super extremists who went to Iran, but there's other groups in the Neturei Karta who don't go that far. So to say that they're not Satmar is not 100% correct, because they're enmeshed with them. And as I said last time, it was only after this Iranian escapade that the Satmar school finally expelled the son of this freedman from Vienna who was created for Shechil Hashem. So they do have real connections. I would say the Satmar Rav loved all Jews, including the non-religious. He didn't hate the non-religious. He hated the non-religious leaders. He didn't hate the typical non-religious. We'll talk about it next class. If you missed last class, it's now online. The Satmar Rebbe, I know someone who went to visit him in Tucson when he was there, and from all accounts, he was not an intense person. He was a delight. He was a pleasure to be around. Rav Yalis said he was the great rabbi of Philadelphia. I heard this from his grandson, that they went to, Rav Yalis took his son-in-law and others to visit the Satmar Rebbe, and it was a wonderful debate, a discussion about everything, and then they got to a little bit to Zionism, and then the Rebbe went crazy. And Rav Yalis said that, if you don't know who Rav Yalis was, he was one of the great American rabbanim. He said that the Satmar Rav was a shotel adavar echad, it's a limited expression. He's a crazy man when it comes to one issue. One issue, you can't talk to him, you can't argue with him, you can't say anything to him. That's his issue. Off that issue, he was a mensch, he was a wonderful person, he was a tzad. I mean, he had one issue that he had what can I say? That was his issue. That was his crazy issue. He had a great sense of humor. He at the expense of the Aguda and the Zionists for the most part. So we're dealing with a man who had an issue. Let's put it this way. He had his whole life was enveloped by this Zionism thing, which he thought had destroyed Torah Judaism. But it wasn't to the point like this is a cult. He still was able to be friendly with all the other Rabbanim and the Rebbes and... the famous, to give an example of one of his jokes, one of his chassidim, this is also a true story, told the Rebbe, he goes, I'm going to go to Rav Aaron Cutler and I'm going to prove to him that he has to join our side, be an anti-Zionist. And so the Rebbe says to him, and what are you going to do when he starts quoting Shas and Poskim? You know, in other words, saying that it was the Rebbe way of saying that this is a debate between us, and that I can tell Rav Aaron Cutler that he doesn't know what he's talking about, but you can't go tell him because you don't know anything. What can I say? We do have a few more minutes. We'll continue next class. Has the anti-Zionism declined since the Tira? There were many hope that it would decline. And the two Rebbes now, Satmar's broken into two, maybe three. They certainly are not great Lamdanim. They're not great intellectuals. What I can say is that after his Tira, one group of Satmar refused to go along with this the previous Rebbe, for the reason I explained. The Satmar Rav was a great Lamdan. And the last Rebbe was not a great Lamdan, and you had a group of people who said that we can't have a Rebbe if he's not also a Rav. Remember, the Satmar Rav Paskin for the community. What are the Rebbe Paskins? There's no other Rebbe in the world who Paskins. They have Dayanim who do that. The Satmar Rav was the postsake. The last Rebbe wasn't. So you have a small group. They call themselves the B'nai Yoel, maybe 15-20%. And they also thought that the new Satmar Rebbe wasn't as extreme when it came to Zionism. But I can say that it really hasn't declined. They don't scream anymore. They don't have rallies anymore like that. but the theory is still there. They don't accept the state of Israel. They don't do any of that. So I guess the noise level has declined. But I guess that was meant to be. What are you going to do? You're going to keep screaming for 100 years? It's inevitable that it was inevitable because if any of these rebbes were to break with the Satmar Rebbe's position, they no longer would be rebbe. The followers would all leave them. The rebbe is such an important force. The rebbe, the Satmar Rav, could have changed things. He could have brought the followers over to a different position like the other rebbes did. And he would have lost a couple, but they all would have gone with him. And he would have been in Moetzes Gedolei Torah. He would have recognized as a universal gadol. He didn't. It's almost as if going against the Lubavitcher Rebbe now, for a Lubavitcher. The Satmar Rebbe, remember, Satmar is not a Hasidus. It was founded by the Satmar Rav. And he was a Rav before he was a Rebbe. So how can you go against the basic, it's like saying you're a Lubavitcher and you're not going to learn Tanya anymore. They don't go to Iran. They go to Yemen, by the way, and they bring Jews from Yemen to Williamsburg. They don't go to Iran. The Turei Karta goes to Iran. Satmar does not go to Iran. Which I consider the Rav politically savvy? Yes, I think he was very politically savvy. He made anti-Zionism acceptable. And at a time after the Holocaust, I think this was the real problem. This is why so many Gedolim were upset and why Rav Henkin said he would have been the Zaken Mamre. When the hands of the non-Jews were still wet with the blood of Jews, when he went before the Goyim and said, protect us against these heretics, basically he appealed to the non-Jews. He appealed to the non-Jews, and a lot of Rabbanim couldn't forgive him for that. But it was politically savvy, because Israel was put under a lot of pressure in the whole world. You had ads in the New York Times, so yes, he was politically savvy. And as I said, it's the greatest Hasidus in the world, and the greatest success story of any Hasidus, coming from maybe 100 families in 1945, 100 families at the most, to 125,000 people, it is the greatest post-war success story. And what can you say? You know, they're going to take over all of us if we don't come up with our own ideology. Okay, if there's no more questions, if there's no more questions, as I said, we'll pick up next Monday night in Mirza Hashem. We will do two sessions on Moshe Feinstein, the great posek of our time. Although I did about 5 minutes of what I wanted to say, so maybe just about 3-4 minutes of the Satmar Rav to begin, and then we'll move into the great Rav Moshe, who together with the Satmar Rav was probably the two greatest figures in American Orthodoxy with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, those three and the Rav, those four I would say. So thank you all, and God willing, we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.